The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Thursday, August the 21st. I'm Belinda Rhodes. On today's podcast, an MI5 research paper on radicalisation seen by The Guardian challenges the stereotypical view of what makes a terrorist.
MI5 say that religious zealotry or fundamentalism isn't driving those who are involved in terrorism. And in fact, many of them do not practice their faith regularly. Some are involved in drug taking, visiting prostitutes, drinking alcohol, and many lack any religious literacy and could actually be regarded as religious novices.
Today's GCSE results are expected to be good, but Schools Minister Lord Adonis admits there's still work to be done in education.
Our biggest challenge over the next few years is to see that all primary school children, as early as possible within their primary school years, get up to standard in the basics of literacy and numeracy.
And music impresario Pete Waterman reminisces about the old days.
We used to, on a Sunday, listen to, you know, the top 40, and I guarantee some nights we'd have 8 of the top 10 records. You know, they were live on the show, and the kids got them for a pound.
That's all coming up, but first, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
At least 153 people have been killed in the worst Spanish air crash for more than 20 years. The Spanair plane had just set off from Madrid for Las Palmas when it broke up and burst into flames. The company's website has published the names of passengers but not their nationalities. It says 20 of those killed were children and 2 were babies. A Spanair spokesman says the MD-82 aircraft was carrying 172 people and the cause of the crash was unknown. A government minister has confirmed reports the plane had aborted one takeoff for checks, but later tried a second takeoff. The Foreign Office says it's not aware of any British nationals involved in the crash. For the latest developments, go to guardian.co.uk/Spain. MI5 has concluded there is no easy way to identify those who become involved in terrorism in Britain. The Guardian has seen a classified internal research document on radicalisation. The sophisticated analysis, based on hundreds of case studies by the security service, says there is no single pathway to violent extremism. It concludes it's not possible to draw up a typical profile of the British terrorist, as most are demographically unremarkable and simply reflect the communities in which they live. The report also plays down the importance of radical extreme clerics, saying their influence in radicalising British terrorists has now moved into the background. Gary Glitter's been stranded at Hong Kong's airport after being denied admission to the country. It's the second destination the British glam rocker's been stopped from entering after his release from a Vietnamese prison for molesting children. The British Consulate General in Hong Kong says Glitter had contacted the office for help, but no further details have been given. He may now be returned to Thailand, which has already refused him entry. Gordon Brown has launched his political fight back, promising to win the next general election. Speaking to journalists on a flight to Beijing, the Prime Minister has brushed aside questions about his leadership, also suggesting there will be no autumn reshuffle. He's also hinting his government would bring forward measures this September to help those hardest hit by the credit crunch. Brown's attempt to reassert his authority follows a summer of dismal by-election defeats, dire poll ratings, criticism of his leadership, and speculation over whether he should step down. Lightning struck twice at the Olympic Games. Usain Bolt has broken the world 200-metre record on the track. Just 4 days earlier, the Jamaican sprinter smashed the 100-metre world record. Later in this programme, we'll be hearing more from our team in Beijing as Welsh swimmer David Davis takes silver in the 10-kilometres event. A last-minute scrambled goal helped spare England's blushes in last night's football friendly with the Czech Republic. It finished 2-2 with Fabio Capello's team twice coming from behind. Scotland's game at Hampden Park ended goalless against Northern Ireland. The Republic of Ireland drew 1-1 in Norway, and in Swansea, Georgia beat Wales 2-1. To this morning's papers now, and the headline in the Times is 153 burnt to death in holiday jet crash. The Independent says it's miraculous there are any survivors at all. The Times also reports on how a suspected scam company has left thousands of furious music fans out of pocket after failing to supply tickets for 3 of Britain's biggest festivals. The Telegraph looks at more comments by Gordon Brown, who says David Miliband poses no threat to him. And the students get their GCSE results today. The paper examines claims some schools are inflating results by forcing pupils to ditch the exams in favour of easier vocational courses. More energy pricing misery in the mail, with families facing even higher bills this winter after a huge rise in the price of gas. The back page of The Express says Brian Barwick is booted out, claiming the FA has ruthlessly sacked its chief executive. And The Sun claims Spurs player Dimitar Berbatov will now face a furious backlash from his own supporters after the paper snapped him signing a Manchester United shirt. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
A UK-restricted MI5 operational briefing note seen by The Guardian reveals that there's no easy way to identify those who might become involved in terrorism. The research circulated within the security service in June challenges many of the stereotypes commonly held about men and women involved in British terrorism, saying, for example, that the majority are British nationals or are here legally. It also has interesting things to say about their religious, social, and educational backgrounds. Home Affairs editor Alan Travis has more on the document and what it contains.
It's a research paper written by a unit inside MI5, the security service, called the Behavioural Science Unit. And it appears to be an attempt to draw up a profile of British terrorists as they exist today, based on what it describes as in-depth case studies of hundreds of examples of people who are either closely involved or associated with terrorism in Britain today.
And the results that the paper has come up with are actually rather surprising, aren't they?
They are indeed, yes, because they're completely counter to our normal expected view of the intelligence services analysis of terrorism. And they say that there's actually no easy way to identify those who become involved in terrorism, in modern-day terrorism in Britain, that Islamist extremists in particular are completely different from the nature of the IRA or the Red Army faction or Islamist extremists abroad, and that there's no single pathway to violent extremism in the recruitment of people to British terrorist groups.
And indeed it challenges some of the very particular stereotypes that many of us hold about those who are likely to become Islamic radicals.
That's quite right. I mean, to run through them, they say, first of all, that the tabloid view of recruits to British terrorist groups are that they're illegal migrants who've come here to claim asylum, living off welfare benefits, who are then trying to bomb us up. And that's the fact they say that the majority are British nationals and the remainder, with a few exceptions, are actually here legally. Around half were actually born in the UK, with others migrating here later in life. Though some have come to claim asylum here, but most of those who've come come to study or for family or economic reasons and become radicalised many years after they migrate here. Also, rather surprisingly, MI5 say that religious zealotry or fundamentalism isn't driving those who are involved in terrorism. And in fact, many of them do not practice their faith regularly. Some are involved in drug taking, visiting prostitutes, drinking alcohol, and many lack any religious literacy and could actually be regarded as religious novices. Indeed, MI5's assessment is that a strong religious faith and a strong religious upbringing could actually protect people from being recruited or turning towards violent extremism.
So is there anything that unifies these people? Is there anything in the document that suggests why people do become radicalised?
MI5 say that while all the well-known influences like the internet, online chat rooms, DVDs, music, books and so on have an influence, the vital, crucial factor that makes the vast majority of discriminated, disenchanted young Muslims who don't turn to violent extremism is personal contact. And they say that in every case, that has to be the presence of that personal contact and recruitment by somebody already involved in a network that makes a difference.
So it sounds as if that, in a way, might be the most useful thing in the document in terms of the continuing fight to prevent terrorism in Britain. How will this help? How will this document help? What will it offer the security services?
Well, MI5 say that their research and analysis has implications for the government's PREVENT programme, as it's called, of work, which is designed to counter the spread of extremist ideology and extremist violence. And they say that indeed it is this kind of seeking on this kind of social bonds of those involved in terrorism, that they provide a way out and a package of measures that they say For example, finding a new relationship, a new child being born, or even a new job could actually see those who seek some kind of family life within inside a terrorist group after the dislocation they've suffered in their previous life as a way of providing an alternative and a way out. They say there aren't conveyor belts to terrorism. Some people talk about conveyor belts towards terrorism. They say that the conveyor belt these people are moving towards, and some are moving away from terrorist groups, and it's possible perhaps to encourage them to move away.
Alan Travis there, and of course there's more on that story on the website. And elsewhere on the website today, you can see pictures of all the possible running mates for Barack Obama, as well as all the latest news and comment on the US elections at guardian.co.uk/US elections 2008. At Comment is Free, you can read Guy Damman's take on why beauty and sexual allure have less and less in common, and Sunda Katwala on how Gordon Brown can take advantage of Britain's Olympic success. And of course, all the latest news and pictures from Beijing at guardian.co.uk/Olympics 2008.
Olympics 2008 from guardian.co.uk.
This is Ian Pryor in Beijing on day 13 of the Olympic Games. Another British medal this morning, again in the open water swimming, where it's been a really good games for Britain following Kerry-Anne Payne and Cassie Patton silver and bronze yesterday. Today was David Davies in the men's event, and again, just like yesterday, he looked like winning for an awful long period before being overhauled in the final straight by the Dutchman Maarten van der Weyden. Davies gave it pretty much everything he had, to the point where he almost collapsed afterwards and needed treatment by paramedics. He described himself as a bit delirious at the end, but he's fine. We were expecting another medal this morning in the BMX, but it's been pouring with rain here in Beijing today, and Sinead Reid has had to wait until tomorrow when that event will resume. Last night at the track, another extraordinary performance by Usain Bolt. Possibly the first time in these games we've seen the man really run. He broke what everyone thought would have been one of the longer-lasting records, breaking Michael Johnson's 1932 world record by 0.2 of a second. Johnson set that record in Atlanta in 1996, but as Bolt showed, he's redefining sprinting here to add to his kind of world record in the 100 metres. It's not all good news for him, though. He's had criticism from Jack Rugger, the president of the IOC, this morning, who says he must show more respect to his opponents. This is in reference to the showboating that has both preceded and come after most of his races. Also with the track last night, a really good result for Britain's Tasha Danvers in the final of the women's 400-metre hurdles. She came in with a bronze medal, but it was a really unexpected one. She's had a terrible year, suffering illness and injury. Her blood cell count was really low. This was another British medal out of almost nowhere. Tonight, we're looking forward to Phillips Adow on the track. He's the favourite in the men's triple jump. For once for Phillips Adow, he's really looked on form in the major championships. There's very high hopes for him. A quick word on the medals table. Britain's still third this morning with 16 gold, 11 silver and 11 bronze. First and second are pretty much uncatchable. That's going to be China and the US. But the big challenge to Britain over the next few days is going to be Russia, who tend to have a greater spread of events in which they can get medals. But Britain already has three more guaranteed in the boxing, where three fighters have made it through to the semi-finals, which means they get bronze regardless of what happens.
For the best coverage of the 2008 Games, go to guardian.co.uk/Olympics.
Today, the first generation of 16-year-olds who've been educated solely under the Labour government will get their GCSE results. The results are again expected to show a rise in the proportion of students awarded top grades. Schools Minister Lord Adonis says this is a reflection of Labour's efforts in education over their 11 years in power, but he admits there's still more work to be done. Polly Curtis talked to Lord Adonis ahead of the publication of the results.
There was a period when I was an education correspondent myself when people, as it were, bought in to the old right-wing argument that more means worse. And ministers in my position used to be very defensive year on year about improvements in results. I remember myself, when I used to question ministers, they would get very defensive and they would point out the fact that the improvement in results was only a small one and that, you know, and sort almost to excuse the fact that standards had risen. I'm not defensive at all. We have doubled real terms education spending in the last 10 years. We have 40,000 more teachers in our schools. We have what Ofsted tell us is the best generation of teachers ever. We have significantly rising levels of aspiration in our schools. We have much stronger school leadership than we had in the past, and of course the quality of school leadership does so much to set the whole level of expectations in a school. I would be severely disappointed if we did not see year-on-year improvements in GCSE results. And in terms of our quest for social justice and promoting social mobility, we need to see a significant increase in the improvement year-on-year. We should not be seeking to denigrate the improvement that takes place when there is no evidence whatever that it is not based soundly on rising standards in our schools. The issue for the future is how we continue to increase the rate of improvement so that all pupils can expect to reach the 5 good GCSE level, which I believe is possible with good teaching and high levels of aspiration, and not to denigrate the achievement of pupils with different learning needs.
One of the big focuses of this year's GCSE results will be that this is the first generation who have been educated solely under Labour. What do you think the achievements have been for their education?
Over the last 11 years since this generation of students started at school, there has been a transformation in the funding and support for schools and in the attainment that flows from that. Real-term spending on education has doubled over that period. 40,000 more teachers, a doubling in the number of support workers in schools. Spending on school buildings and facilities has gone up by 10 times in the last 10 years. Expectations have risen very significantly in that period, and we've seen the results flowing from it. Very significant improvements in key stage test results and a one-third improvement in the proportion of 16-year-olds getting 5 or more good GCSEs, including English and Maths. That's a phenomenal statistic. We still have, what I term the stubborn 20% who aren't reaching the standard that we expect in literacy and numeracy by the age of 11. Now, that figure was nearly twice as large 10 years ago, so we have narrowed the, reduced the that proportion significantly. But to my mind, our biggest challenge over the next few years is to see that all primary school children, as early as possible within their primary school years, get up to standard in the basics of literacy and numeracy.
Lord Adonis talking to Polly Curtis.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
I'm Belinda Rhodes. Still to come in today's Guardian Daily, a taster of the contenders for the IFDOT Comedy Awards to be announced this week.
I'm still at that stage where if someone says, do you want to do a poetry festival, I'll be there with my pentameter. If someone says, do you want to present celebrity haircuts, I'll give it a go. If I hate it, I don't have to redo it. So I'm just enjoying the ride, then I'll settle down and who knows, it could be BBC Four, it could be E4. We'll wait and see what happens. I've got the hair for one and the mind for the other.
But first, American support for Georgia during the recent fighting there has cemented relations between Georgia and the West and highlighted Georgia's ambitions to join NATO, which the alliance has agreed will happen at some point in the future. But Russia has been angered by what it sees as a US-dominated alliance forming around it. An agreement this week between Poland and the United States allowing part of a US missile defense system to be based in Poland has only heightened tensions. But Washington argues that the new defense system will protect Poland, the US, and much of Europe against attacks from rogue states like Iran. While NATO is shoring itself up against potential new threats, however, many would argue that it's not dealing with existing ones, like the insurgency in Afghanistan, particularly well. I asked our security editor, Richard Norton-Taylor, whether NATO has lost its focus.
Well, I think you'll find a lot of people in NATO, both senior officials but also NATO governments, will say, yes, the organisation has lost its focus for a number of reasons. I mean, it was built up as a military alliance during the Cold War. Now, a lot of countries cut their, including Britain actually, cut their defence budgets after the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1989 and so on. And the first big crisis, the first time NATO has actually joined or come together in a ground conflict against the Taliban in Afghanistan, and it is not winning. It's a NATO conflict, and NATO says we'll embrace this conflict, we'll together fight the Taliban, and they have not. And that is very, very serious, unprecedented, I think, when it comes to the questioning the credibility of the NATO alliance. Yet at the same time, of course, we've got other countries like Georgia, former Soviet Union, Soviet bloc countries like Georgia and then Ukraine, wanting to join it because they say they're concerned about Russia.
So, as you mentioned, NATO was set up in a very different era. So is it simply no longer the right tool for the job?
That's a good question. I think it a lot of people are asking that too, and because it is essentially a military organization, as we say. And what kind of military exercise is it going to get engaged in the future? Everybody says now, and he's sort of saying, I would say, saying sort of minister and official would say that you cannot win the battle against any insurgency, and certainly not against Taliban in Afghanistan by military means alone. I mean, British generals would say that. We can maybe help initially sort of secure the ground, but you've got to have civil reconstruction of the country and so on and so forth, hearts and minds and all that. And that NATO cannot do. And NATO is essentially a US-led, US-dominated military organization. There's a lot of debate actually going on now about what this alliance is for. Now, a lot will depend, actually, I think, on the US presidential elections. I mean, NATO is not going to dissolve, but it may slowly become increasingly redundant, especially if one thinks that, you know, no one is going to use military power against countries. I mean, the US made it quite clear that it wouldn't use military power to help Georgia, for example, and it's certainly not going to do it against Ukraine.
If NATO has lost its way, it's not quite sure what its role is in the modern day, what does it have to gain from allowing countries like Georgia and potentially the Ukraine to join?
There is an increasing realization amongst even establishment figures, really, and independent analysts who are pretty conservative, really. So it's not a sort of right-wing, left-wing ideological sort of interpretation. And that is that NATO is becoming sort of redundant and indeed should not have even encouraged Georgia and it should not encourage Ukraine to join it, because that's going to be destabilizing. I mean, let everyone calm down. Russia is where it is. Already you've got the Baltic countries, you know, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and so on, joining NATO, banding. And also, as a question, as we know, Poland, the US now agreeing not only on having missile defense system in Poland, which the Russians say is against our missiles, which may not be, but also you're getting, because the poll asked for it, 100 US troops in Poland manning American anti-missile missiles, which are notionally targeting against Russian missiles, which is all, again, a sort of rather theoretical. It's not going to happen, but it could happen by accident if this sort of mini arms race goes on in this part of the world.
And that was Richard Norton Taylor.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Now, for 25 years, the most sought-after awards among British comedians were the Perriers, named after the fizzy water brand that sponsored them. Past winners have often gone on to enjoy huge success, like Eddie Izzard, Steve Coogan, The League of Gentlemen and Peter Kay. The awards are now called the If.com Comedies. The title sponsor is the Edinburgh-based internet bank If.com. And this year's shortlist, drawn from the best of the Edinburgh Fringe, has been announced. We've been putting on our own show at Edinburgh, live at the Gilded Balloon, featuring a daily selection of the best fringe acts.
The Guardian live at the Edinburgh Fringe, 2008.
Hi, I'm Miles Jupp. I've just stepped off stage after a recording of our podcast, The Guardian Live with the Gilded Balloon, and I have been handed a list of nominations for the If.com Comedy Awards. We've been lucky enough to have a number of them pop by into The Guardian podcast. Here's a selection of the best bits.
Please welcome Russell Kane!
I'm still at that stage where if someone says, do you want to do a poetry festival, I'll be there with my pentameter. If someone says, do you want to present celebrity haircuts, I'll give it a go. If I hate it, I don't have to redo it. So I'm just enjoying the ride, then I'll settle down and who knows, it could be BBC Four, it could be E4. We'll wait and see what happens. I've got the hair for one and the mind for the other. And
here he is, Rod Gilbert!
Your show is called Rod Gilbert and the Award-Winning Mince Pie.
It's about me having a nervous breakdown over a mince pie in Knutsford service station. What's weird is that I say Knutsford in the show, but then journalists are adding bits to this all the time, adding details that I don't put in. Like somebody said Knutsford service station just off Junction 18, blah, blah. I didn't know that. And it was my breakdown.
Please welcome Sarah Millican.
I wasn't prepared at all. I should have done a bit more research on penis size related to how much alcohol intake you have during the festival. I hadn't done any research at all. Do you go out drinking? After the...
No.
Right answer.
Yeah, I used to, but because all my mates always call me Donkey Boy, I just got...
Is that because of your face?
Please welcome David O'Doherty.
My beefs, 2008. Excuse me while I unleash some hate. Celebrity news. Stop appearing at the end of real news. You diminish the real news. And the death toll from the earthquake could rise as high as 15,000. Christina Aguilera's cat has alopecia. No!
Well, we wait with bated breath to see who will win. In the meantime, do keep downloading these podcasts at theguardian.co.uk/audio.
And as Miles says, if you want to hear more from those acts, you can download our Fringe podcasts at guardian.co.uk/Edinburgh. The winner of the IFTOT comedies will be announced on Saturday. It's not unheard of nowadays to hand over £120 to see top acts like Madonna or George Michael in concert. So imagine paying just £1 to watch Kylie Minogue and getting a free drink and a burger with it. The music producer and impresario Pete Waterman has been remembering the heady days of the 80s when he took the Aussie songstress and a host of other performers on the road for 56 nights. The tickets were cut price and the venues were tiny, but it was a gamble which paid off, as he's been telling Hannah Poole in G2.
We had a tour bus, so we went out on tour, 14 acts on the bus, £1 to get in, and you got a free Coke and a free beef burger as well. I mean, you know, seeing Kylie Minogue, you paid £1, you got a free drink and a free burger. You know, I mean, who had done that before? Nobody had ever done it before. And then suddenly, since then, they've all done, you know, the school tours and all that. But we just got 14 acts on a bus, and we had to have a couple of parents on there, and we just went off, and we did 56 nights. And I have to say, I remember some of those gigs. Some weeks, we have four of the top 10 acts. You know, I remember we used to, on a Sunday, listen to, you know, the top 40. And I guarantee some nights we'd have eight of the top 10 records. You know, they were live on the show. And the kids got in for £1. You know, it was like watching Top of the Pops in your local Locarno or your local Tiffany's or your local Rialto. It was incredible. And it was just great fun. And the kids knew that we meant it. We you know, they bought millions of records. And we just thought, we'll go out to their town. So we went to Huddersfield and we went to Sheffield and we went Kilmarnock. And places that nobody'd ever gone. You know, I mean, I didn't have to do it because I was selling a million records whether we went on their own or not. But I just thought that Jason Donovan and Kylie Minogue and whoever had to sit on the bus and go to places like Barnsley. We did Barnsley. I mean, the kids in Barnsley couldn't believe it. They kept saying to me, why have you come here? Well, because you're here, yeah? Yeah, but why have you come here? Well, you buy our records. Yeah, but we would have gone to Sheffield. No, but we wouldn't have gone to Barnsley. It was really weird, but it was fantastic.
They sound like they were sort of your golden era.
Well, no, I mean, the ironic thing everybody thinks it is, but I mean, we sold more records with Steps than anybody. We did 26 nights at Wembley with Steps. I mean, everybody just forgets that, you know, this band was enormous. I always say that, you know, the PWL Kylie Jason years and the Rick Astley years, they were the training period. And whatever I learnt during that period, although obviously it was usually successful, when we put it into Steps, it really was gold time. I mean, I didn't go on the road with Steps, but I mean, because they had their own manager at that time, but it all moved on. But, I mean, we'd never sold as many records.
Are you gearing up for another hit?
I'm always gearing up for another hit, whether one comes out or not. And the one thing I've learned all my life is you never know where there's a hit. You have to accept that at 61, most people think you're too old. But most people thought I was too old at 51. And everybody thought I was too old at 41. So, you know, I aged. That's the other thing. Again, it's like it's ageism thing. I'm not too old. I love pop music. And my son who's 27, I hear some quite weird things in my house at times. But, you know, some of it I really, really like. You know, I really like them. And I, you know, Umbrella. I remember coming in and going, that's number one record. Well, you were joking. I went, I'm telling you, that is a number one record. Ella, I said, I love it. And everybody thought it was balmy. And it went number one. They went, how did you know that was going to be a number one record? And I said, because, you know, I'm only 60. I'm not dead. I know my hair's going thin, but my ears ain't.
That was Pete Waterman, and you can read the full interview at guardian.co.uk/theguardian/G2. And that's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. Producing today, Fiona Plant and Andy Duckworth. I'm Belinda Rhodes. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.